You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vona. This is The Public Eye. You know, most people think of the bootlegging period back in the 20s as being something that only the big shots, the mobsters from Chicago like Al Capone ran. Well, not true. In fact, my guest this week is educator and author Bob Batchelor. His new book is The Bourbon King, The Life and Crimes of George Remus, Prohibition's Evil Genius. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking about George Remus, who really, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, is someone who fell between the cracks, a major bootlegger, if not the biggest bootlegger of that period. The lifestyle that he led and how he was able to, if you will, rise to the top of the bootlegging industry. Bob, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Why? First of all, I mean, you and I talked a little bit before broadcast. I mean, guys like Capone, the you know, that big syndicate that he had in Chicago, you would think these were the guys that had bootlegging from coast to coast all tied up. But this guy, George Remus, surfaces. How did you come across him?
Well, about 17 years ago, if you can believe it, I was asked to write a little piece on bootlegging by a prominent historian for a reference book. And so I came across George Remus. I couldn't get this guy out of my mind. He stuck in my ear like a bad 80s hair metal band song. And as I continued with my career, I just kept running back across George Remus. So when I was looking for a new project, I thought, well, this is somebody that I can kind of rediscover from history, and it's a big story that still has ramifications today. So I pursued him, and I just so happened to live in Cincinnati now, which was George Remus's playground.
A lot of these guys start off from a very young age. Maybe the parents divorced or weren't really focused on their children, so they had kind of the run of the neighborhood. They get mixed up with the wrong people. What kind of upbringing did this guy Remus have?
Remus didn't have a typical criminal background like many of the people that we know so well from pop culture. Instead, he did have kind of a rough upbringing because he was a German-American at a time when there was a lot of anti-German sentiment in the United States. He became a pharmacist at a pretty young age. He started out working as a pharmacy clerk in his uncle's shop at about 13, 14 years old because his dad had an alcohol problem and health problems. And so Remus had to support the family. So he became the primary breadwinner of his family quite young. And luckily, his uncle had a pharmacy. And at that time, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, for a German immigrant, becoming something like a pharmacist was about as high as he could probably aspire to. So it was a good career for him. It took somebody with a lot of smarts because pharmacists were like small town doctors back then. So it placed him at the center of the community where he lived in suburban Chicago, and it gave him a lot of status in the community.
Now, here's the part that really threw me as we're talking about a guy with not, as you said, not a strong criminal background, had a lot of brains, had a lot of smarts, and he became a pharmacist. But this is the one that shocked me. Then became an attorney, right? A defense attorney.
Yeah, it's quite a shocking transformation. But Remus wanted a bigger life. And I think that he saw some different avenues other than pharmacy as ways to achieve a bigger life. He saw himself as somebody almost presidential, you know, destined to greatness. And for him, he had seen the insides of the medical industry from being a pharmacist, and he thought the entire medical field was basically quackery. So he turns to the law and begins taking correspondence courses and night classes at a local law school. Within a couple years, he's got his law degree, and he comes under the halo of Clarence Darrow, who was one of the real heroes of that age. And it starts this law career where he becomes a defense attorney. I like to joke he's somewhat like the Johnny Cochran of Chicago in the early 1900s.
Does he get, I mean, a pharmacist and then an attorney? So I get the sense that he became quickly disillusioned, though, with these, you know, with these more mainstream professions, and then finally ends up as a bootlegger. Was it the money that was the lure? Was it the type of people that he would become engaged with? Or was it the fact that he was doing something against the law?
I think that the first point is that he wanted more. He saw himself as somebody destined for greatness, and he knew that money was part of that. He became quite rich. I mean, he was making $45,000, $50,000 a year as one of the top criminal defense attorneys in America. This is a time when a house cost probably, you know, $1,000 to $3,000. So he was quite rich, but he started to see petty thugs who were involved with bootlegging. And when the judges would find them, they would pull out rolls of $100 bills and just pay the fines right off the bat. He saw that money and said to himself, if these simpletons can make thousands, I can put my smarts to this and I can make millions pretty quickly.
So it sounds like, and not unlike many people, whether you're on the criminal side of things or you're just everyday working man or woman, the money was the lure. He wanted to live big and he wanted to live large.
Yep, he wanted to have a fantastic life. He knew that money could lead him that way. And he had happened to meet a woman named Imogene who would become his second wife. And when their affair began, she pumped his ego and pushed him to making more money because she was as celebrity-crazed and as money-crazed as he was. And so that lethal combination put those two on a path toward criminality.
Now, it may sound a little bit ridiculous, but I got to assume that to be profitable in this business, one, you have to be ruthless, but also you have to keep your wits about you. What I'm saying is, I'm going to go out on the limb here and say that Remus was probably more of a teetotaler. He just saw this as you said, the opportunity to live as large as possible, and this fueled his desires.
Yeah, people who have looked at Remus claim that he was a teetotaler. My research uncovered that he certainly wasn't. That was part of his public image. He was really good at spinning the media to look at things the way that he did, and he wanted to present this super clean background, providing whiskey to the world, but not himself being a drinker. But that's not really true. But he was a criminal mastermind, as you say. He was a ruthless person. But he was also a pretty great business person for somebody who was uneducated, essentially, and untrained in that field. His real goal, he claims, was to corner the bourbon market so that he could then send bourbon overseas because it was still legal to sell bourbon to Europe and to Canada. It just wasn't as profitable as the black market.
The bourbon, and that becomes the centerpiece of this whole story. And I'm not even sure. I mean, that's why I'm asking you. Was bourbon, the number one hard liquor? Was that the thing that was in demand, or did it depend on what resources you had?
They used to call it Kentucky Dew, and that's what they like the dew in the morning. They used to call Kentucky bourbon the best in the world. I think people still think it's the best in the world, rightly so. And Remus, what his claim to fame was in the underground, was that he gave people access to the best booze. So they didn't have to drink rot gut or bathtub gin, which would later become really popular. Remus was a conduit to getting the highest quality American whiskeys and bourbons. People were willing to pay for that, particularly a lot of wealthy people in Cincinnati, in this region, throughout the Midwest. He was shipping bourbon to the larger metropolitan areas like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago. So really, Remus's claim to fame is he saw the value in purchasing these distilleries for pennies on the dollar and then basically stealing from himself and getting that bourbon into the black market.
Bob, when you talked about the quality of his bourbon being top tier, at least at that point in history, I'm going to assume that he was also smart enough to realize, well, I've got the cream of the crop, so let me sell it to those people who were very affluent. Was that his market?
That was part of his market, certainly. As he got larger and became a national figure, sending bourbon everywhere, he still delivered to areas, the richest, wealthiest segments of different cities. He would have people drive specifically to those areas to fulfill orders, but he also filled orders just for common speakeasies and others. Probably in those cases, those rum runners would water down the whiskey probably two or three times to sell it to unsuspecting people at maybe just as much money, but not quite as quality in terms of what they were getting. But yeah, he had not only wealthy clientele, but he had rich and powerful clientele. He supplied to Washington, D.C., many of the legislators, even at the national level, congressmen, senators who were still drinking at that time, were drinking Remus bourbon.
So the same people that were writing the laws prohibiting it were drinking it.
Exactly. Yep. As you can imagine, would be the case.
What was it? You got to assume that, especially with his legal background, that there had to be a lot of payoffs. As you said, legislators, judges, lawyers, police, anybody that would have turned him in. I mean, was there a lot of payola?
There was a ton of payola. You really hit on an important point. Remus used a lot of his wealth to line the pockets from the local beat cop, who many of those people would, for, say, $10 a week and a couple pints of bourbon, patrol his compound for him, keeping other rum runners, who they called pirates, away, because it started battles between rum runners. So guys were trying to steal, and they were using semi-automatic weapons and other means to try to steal from one another. But his bribery network went right up to the White House, and it's one of the really black marks on Warren G. Harding's administration. Remus had a direct conduit into Harry Doherty's office. Harry Doherty was the attorney general, ultimately responsible for overseeing prohibition enforcement. He had a toady kind of valet-type character named Jess Smith that he was best friends with, and Smith allegedly had taken between $250,000 and $300,000 in direct bribes from Remus to ensure that no matter what happened, he would never end up behind bars. And there's a lot of ways to calculate money. The most recent and kind of scientific ways, you could probably say that $250,000 would be probably 5 to 10 times as much in today's money.
Yeah,
it's amazing amount of money.
Yeah, it's incredible, because you talk about that throughout the book, the amount of money, and I guess by today's standards, people would think, well, that's not even enough to buy a three-bedroom home. But back then, that was a lot of money. So people got rich very quickly if they were in the right place at the right time. We're going to take a quick pause. You're listening to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vone, your host. My guest this week is best-selling author and educator Bob Batchelor. His new book is The Bourbon King, The Life and Times of a former pharmacist, attorney, and then bootlegger George Remus. I keep chuckling on that, Bob, because people today would think, God, a pharmacist makes good money and very respectable, a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. But Remus just, was never satisfied. But it wasn't just him. It was living, as you said, he wanted to live large. But I would assume that the people that he surrounded himself with had a lot of influence too, especially his second wife, Imogene. What was the relationship like between those two?
They had a really interesting relationship, and at times she comes off almost like a film noir femme fatale. She's very conniving. Right when she met Remus, before she had really locked him down, she told one of her friends, "I'm going to roll him for my role." And that's probably my wife and I's favorite line from the entire book. It's so 1920s. You can almost, "You're going to roll him for his role, see?" That kind of thing. It's really funny. But, I mean, it's an amazing story when two people who are as ambitious and, I guess, kind of willing to break the law as Imogene and George are, when they get together, they can really do some pretty phenomenal things. But in their case, they did it all underhandedly and in the black market. One of the things I really am proud of, I uncovered quite a bit about her past that nobody had ever really seen before. One of the things that I found is she tried on different identities as a young-ish woman. She would send out press releases because the newspaper was really the way that you became famous back then.
Right.
So you get into the newspapers, your status goes up. And right. She was trying to become famous for probably a decade before she ever met Remus. Nobody had really tracked this down. She was using different variations. Her nickname was Gussie, so sometimes it would be Mrs. Albert Holmes, which was her first husband. Other times it would be Gussie. Sometimes she would be Jean Holmes. She played around with identities, trying to see which one of these can I become famous on. But then she met Remus, and he was already a star. I mean, he was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, on papers around the country, because he had been representing all these murderers and been successful in keeping them from the electric chair.
So I get the sense that, as you said, she was basically an opportunist. Let's call it what it is. Was there any true emotion? Was there any real love in the marriage?
That's a hard one to talk about or think about. I mean, you know, it's hard to dive into somebody's marriage. It seems that they were romantic. It seems they were in love, but I think there's a certain level of putting everything else aside to achieve your goals.
Right.
And, you know, I hate to use such a today comparison, but I sometimes I think of Remus was like maybe the Michael Jordan, or for your listeners, the Larry Bird of bootlegging. You know, he's willing to put everything else aside, and I think his emotional state was much less important to him than making the money. And he was kind of one of like these characters that we have, guys who know that they want to be president from an early age, and they just become resolute in their desire to achieve whatever it is that is that end goal. And for him, it was wealth and fame.
When you talk about that, and you know, I know we've kind of used these parallels of then and then today, in terms of comparison, in terms of money, and you know, the newspaper being the catalyst for fame and hopefully fortune. But today you get a Wall Street, someone who's made it big on Wall Street, or someone's made it big in the tech industry, and you know, they're front page news, homes all over the world. Is that the kind of living that this guy did? Did he have homes in different places? Did he have a big yacht? Did he travel extensively? Did he attend social events to get his face in the paper?
One of the things that Remus did that really did kind of stick throughout history is that supposedly he was one of the models for Jay Gatsby, for F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. So my research, I uncovered that, you know, he was one of many. So many people will say that he was the one and only, but that's not really true. But your listeners can find out more about that in the book. But he did live this kind of larger-than-life lifestyle. He bought a mansion and kind of completely refurbished it in the western suburbs, the kind of Tony suburbs of Cincinnati at that time. He had a building of his own that became the Remus Building in downtown. Now it's a parking lot for the football stadium, but the building used to sit there, and he put a couple $100,000 into renovating that building and that floor for himself. He had a suite at the Sinton Hotel, which was one of the most luxurious hotels in the Midwest at the time. So Remus was not, he wasn't the kind of guy who collected houses, but he liked to travel in style. When he went to a different city to either spread his bribery network or open new markets, he stayed in the finest hotels, ate at the nicest restaurants. That was the kind of character he was. He liked to travel in style.
And he was kind of eclectic. In the book, you know, he didn't like things touching his skin, so a lot of silk was part of his wardrobe, and no underwear.
Yeah. People really find that one funny, and it is. It's it came out in his insanity trial that they were trying to prove, you know, if we fast forward, you know, several years, one of the great things is that the Yale Law Library has Charlie Taft's original court transcripts. So I read those court transcripts a couple times. They're probably somewhere between, I didn't count them, 5,000 to 7,000 pages of transcripts.
Wow.
And Remus actually had to testify in the insanity trials. He didn't testify in the first trial in which he defended himself for murdering Imogene, but he later testified, and so much comes out in that detail because they could, it was pretty much free-flowing. They could ask him anything, and yeah, his quirks came out. He was a interesting guy. I mean, I think he was built like maybe a fullback in the NFL. I mean, he's, you know, probably maybe 5'6", 210, 220 pounds. Mm-hmm. Supposedly was strong as an ox. He could manhandle somebody pretty quick.
Yeah.
This was a ruthless character. You know, as you mentioned earlier, this was really ruthless. You wouldn't want to have a beer with this guy. I mean, he had a charismatic side, but he also had a hair-trigger temper that might produce some brass knuckles or a gold tip weighted cane that he carried around as a weapon.
Yeah, you get the impression, and certainly after reading the book, it came through very clearly that you know, as dapper as he was, and in spite of his education background, the fact of the matter is this was a dangerous, notorious guy. Bob, as we start to wind down, any children? Did he have any offspring?
He did not have any children. He had a stepdaughter. I mean, he adopted Ruth, who was Imogene's daughter from her first marriage. But later, with all we haven't really even touched on Remus's murder of Imogene, which is one of the central features of the book. But that'll leave something good for your listeners to think about.
Right.
He adopted her, but then she had that dissolved later.
Okay, so there really wasn't any, you know, warm, cozy feeling between stepdaughter and stepdad, and especially after, you know, he allegedly murders the mother. Was there a fortune? Was there something left at the end, or did he die broke?
People assume that he died broke because a lot of newspapers looked back on him when he died in the mid-50s and said, yeah, he died poor in a flop house in Covington, Kentucky, but that none of that's really true, and I uncover a lot of instances in which it shows that was just journalists taking an easy path at that time. He had money. When he went to jail, Imogene ran off with one of the federal agents that was responsible for putting him behind bars. They spent about the next 3 years depleting his fortune, doing the same kind of thing, staying at luxury hotels, hiding money away, giving cars and jewels and everything away. It's a pretty fascinating story. That whole part probably could have been a book in and of itself.
Right.
Chasing after, you know, Remus gets out of jail and chases after them, and he's got detectives watching them and spies, and it's the love triangle as it plays out is really fascinating. But they spent a lot of his money, and the reason Remus could never become the Bourbon King again after he got out of jail is because he didn't have the money to hire an army. And during the mid to late 1920s, bootlegging had turned violent. So you had guys like Capone who were building armies, and they were staking
right.
out territories.
Right.
And so Remus just couldn't compete after so much of his money had been evaporated.
It's definitely an intriguing, amazing story, actually, because he was not until now, till you bring him to light, a household name. Not like a Capone, but the life that this man lived, and the circles that he traveled, and even if it wasn't right up to the end of his life, the massive amount of money that was spent, and the lifestyle, the lavish lifestyle, all because of Prohibition. So a very interesting read, The Bourbon King: The Life and Crimes of George Remus, Prohibition's Evil Genius. Bob, certainly people may have questions and want to post questions to you directly. Is there a website or an email?
Sure. You can go to my website, which is just my name, bobbatchelor.com. I'm also on Twitter at Cult Pop Culture, and I have a Facebook page set up for The Bourbon King. So I like to share information that I didn't put in the book, and new stuff that I find when I run across it. So on Facebook, there's a Bourbon King page as well.
And I got to say, and I'm not just saying that because Bob's our guest this week, but it is one of those books that you pick up, and once you do, you can't put it down. Because one chapter after another, there's never a dull moment. I mean, this guy just keeps getting more entrenched in the Prohibition industry. But beyond that, so much of his background and the individuals, Imogene being one of the main characters that was so much a part of his life. Again, The Bourbon King is the book. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.